End of last class, we were looking at the last five chapters of Judges. What did I propose? I don't know if you agreed with it or not, so we'll ask, but what did I propose the last five chapters of Judges showed us? They did what they wanted to do. What was it saying? Chapter 17 and 21, what did it say?
It says that in those days there was no king in Israel, every man did what was right in his own eyes.
So there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. We'll get to that phrase again. We'll dissect it a little bit. But you know, as we move into lesson 3 and we move into 1 Samuel, I want to kind of pick back up. You know, so the last five chapters of Judges, I presented the idea that you saw the state of the nation. You know, so God brought these people, His people, into the land that He had promised. He fulfilled His promise. He kept His covenant. And what did these people do? They turned away from Him. Not only did they turn away from Him, but they perverted His word so much that they justified in their own eyes the way that the law should be construed. They didn't either completely forsook Him, or they were selfish. They weren't humble in God's eyes. And when they went to make decisions, they didn't approach God. They didn't ask what He wanted them to do. They worshipped in the way they wanted. They weren't respectful. They weren't obedient to what He would have them do. So, moving into chapter 3, I have that. We'll talk about Samuel, but first I want to look at what I'm going to call a case study. We're going to look at Hannah versus Eli. Can y'all tell me who Hannah and Eli are? Hannah is the mother of Samuel. Yes, ma'am.
And the other wife,
Peninnah.
And she prayed to God. Eli thought she was doing it. But he said her prayers would be answered or something like that.
Okay. So, but we have Hannah, who, well, we'll get to the story as much, but Hannah is the mother of Samuel. Now, who's Eli? He's a high priest. All right, now I want to call this a case study. I want to look at these two for a second. I want to compare the two of them to see kind of how backwards this nation is right now. So let's look at the faith of Hannah. We'll look at 1 Samuel. I'll read a few verses as we go through, but we'll read each of these verses and then we'll kind of discuss Hannah a little bit more. So 1 Samuel 3 says, "Now this man, that being Elkanah, would go up from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests to the Lord there. When the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and her daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had closed her womb." Skip down to verse 10. "She, being Hannah, was greatly distressed, prayed to the Lord, and wept bitterly. She made a vow and said, 'O Lord of hosts, if you would indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall never come on his head.'" In verse 19, it says that the Lord remembered her and she was able to bear a son. Skip down to verse 22. So 1 Samuel 1:22. "But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, 'I will not go up until the child, that being Samuel, who was born to her, is weaned. Then I will bring him, that he may appear before the Lord and stay there forever.'" Verse 24. "Now when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, with the three-year-old bull and one ephah of flour and a jug of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, although the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull and brought the boy to Eli. She said, 'O my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood here beside you praying to the Lord. For this boy I prayed, and the Lord has given me my petition, which I ask him. So I have also dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is dedicated to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there." So in these verses, what do you see about Hannah? She has this great faith. We've just talked about how wicked this nation is and how perverse and perverted they have gotten with the laws of God or just completely turning away. But here we can still see that there were people, there were men and women who were faithful to the Lord, who were godly, who were righteous. Not only Elkanah, who went up continually with his wives, but you have Hannah, who you see, she put her reliance in God, her faith in God. She prayed. She was distressed. God heard her. Do you think that she was a faithful, dedicated servant of God? I would say so. I think you can see that plainly. Even more so as we look at, and we'll read the entire context here, chapter 2, 1 through 11. Because I want to look at the faith of Hannah and how dedicated and devoted she is and devout to God. And then we'll look at Eli. So 2:1 it says, "Then Hannah prayed and said, 'My heart exults in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth speaks boldly against my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is no one holy like the Lord. Indeed, there is no one beside you, nor is there any rock like our God. Boast no more so very proudly. Do not let ignorance come out of your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and with him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are shattered, but the feeble gird on strength. Those who were full hire themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry cease to hunger. Even the barren gives birth to seven. But she who has many children languishes. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and rich. He brings low and he also exalts. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with nobles and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillar of the earth are the Lord's, and he set the world on them. He keeps the feet of his godly ones, but the wicked ones are silenced in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. Those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Against him he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king, and he will exalt the horn of his anointed one.'" We'll go to verse 10. That's faith. She knows who God is. She knows he's in control of all things. All things come by him, through him. How great a faith that was. She prayed and she put her petitions before God. God didn't have to answer her, but he knew that she was a faithful servant of his. And we can see her through this prayer of thanksgiving, you know, her faith and dependency on God in this time. Now, before we move to Eli, thoughts, comments on Hannah? Anything that y'all saw that I haven't mentioned?
It's easy to have faith when things are going good, everything's peachy.
Mm-hmm.
She was being mistreated. She was things weren't going well. She still had that faith, so that's something to consider.
It is. I mean, well, and it was out of her control. I mean, she was not only being mistreated, but she wasn't able to bear children at the time. Out of her control. She could languish. She could sit there and just, woe is me, and fall into a fit of self-pity. But she petitioned God, and God chose to hear her. I think that we can understand that we should be able to. And it doesn't mean that God will answer us, but we should turn to God in those times of distress and petition him, knowing that he is capable of any and all things. So we see after that, we won't read the verses, but we see that she not only dedicated Samuel, but she continued year by year coming back up and it shows that she provided, I think, an ephod each year for Samuel. Now, on the flip side, so this is just a woman of the nation. Now we're going to look at Eli, who is the high priest. And what do we see about him? All right, so 1 Samuel 2:12. Now, the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. And the customs of the priests with the people. When any man was offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with the three-pronged fork in his hand. And then he would thrust it into the pan. I'm going to skip that. The point I wanted to make here is that Eli's sons didn't know the customs of the priests or the people. Now skip down to verse 17. It says, "Thus the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord. The men despised the offering of the Lord." So now you have Eli, the high priest, and we find something out about his kids. They're worthless men. They don't know the customs of the priests. And that's what they are. And then they were abusing and taking advantage of the sacrifices that were being made. They were mishandling that whole situation. "Thus the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, and they were despised." Look over at 22. Verse 22 says, now Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And he said to them, why do you do such things? The evil things that I hear from all these people. No, my sons, for the report is not good, which I hear the Lord's people circulating. If one man sins against another, God will mediate for him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for the Lord desired to put them to death. Now, they're wicked. They're worthless men. And here he is. He goes to him. Why would you do such evil things that I hear from the people? Now, do you see a problem with that already off the bat? What problem do you see with Eli's comments to his sons? Got to read my mind for this one. My problem is he's the high priest and he's charged his sons with being to taking on these responsibilities, but he's got to hear it from the people. He's responsible for the worship of the nation. He's responsible for making these sacrifices, and he has to hear it from the other people. He's very old. They didn't know the customs of the priests. This, to me, is indication of a problem. He says, why do you do such things, the evil things that I hear from all these people? Not only as a father, but as a high priest, shouldn't you know what's going on with your sons, other priests? Skip down to verse 29. This is a man of God who came to Eli. Verse 29 says, why do you kick at my sacrifice and at my offering which I have commanded in my dwelling? And honor your sons above me by making yourselves fat with the choicest of every offering of my people Israel. Therefore, the Lord God of Israel declares, I did indeed say that your house and the house of your father should walk before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me, I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. You will see the distress of my dwelling in spite of all the good that I do for Israel, and an old man will not be in your house forever. Yet I will not cut off every man of yours from my altar, so that your eyes will fail from weeping and your soul grieve, and all the increase of your house will die in the prime of life. This will be the sign to you which you will come concerning your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. On the same day, both of them will die. Look back at verse 30. He says, for those who honor, verse 29. Why do you kick at my sacrifices and at my offerings, which I have commanded in my dwelling, and honor your sons above me? Now, up until this point, we might be able to use conjecture to see Eli wasn't doing right. But here he's being judged by God, that he is honoring his sons above God. He's allowing this to happen. He's being rebuked. We're going to go on and look at chapter 3 and see that he's rebuked and he's being held accountable for his deeds and his actions. So I put on here, you know, some what I consider to be describing words of Eli based on the rebuke that he's given. I think he's lethargic. If you're going to allow this to happen, these priests, your sons, regardless, take away the fact that he's sons, doesn't matter. Any priest that comes behind you, you're in charge of the worship of the nation. He's lethargic. If he's not, you know, he's not taking action. How about he's tolerant? Allows this to happen. How about he's indifferent? I mean, he allows it to happen, but it's almost like he didn't care until he was older in life. And then I ask the question, and I'll be curious to know your answer. Was he corrupt? Was he corrupted? What would you consider corrupt in this matter? That's an open-ended question. You have your own opinions on that.
I don't know that he was corrupted. I think he just gave up.
I kind of agree. From what I can tell, it doesn't say that he didn't perform worship like he should or offer like he should. It was just the fact that he allowed this other stuff to happen. But see here that he's being held accountable for being indifferent and for being tolerant and for being lethargic in these matters. And I don't know, do y'all have any other descriptive words? Those are the things that came to me. Like, he just never took action. He just allowed this to creep in, allowed it to happen. I mean, if they didn't know the customs, that's what it says in verse 13. I mean, that's his responsibility as well.
You have to wonder, it said in verse 12, they did not know the Lord and the custom of the priests. Surely they knew about Jehovah. Surely they knew about the priests. So no here has to mean either they felt acknowledged and respect, and it may, I don't know, there's not enough data to know, point to Eli's failure to teach and stress that upon them, because later he's judged for his voice. So here's a man in a position of responsibility that could teach his boys about Jehovah. Is that where he failed? That he didn't teach them to, quote, know the Lord, what the Lord expected out of priests? I don't know, but that may point to the thing that you're talking about. A failure that actually started many years before.
Yes. And yeah, there's two trains of thought you can take on this, and it doesn't matter because you end up in the same result. Did they not know the Lord? Were they not taught to respect the Lord? Or did they? And then when they turned from God, Eli just didn't rebuke or restrain them. And that's what First Samuel 3:13 is going to talk about. Either way, they didn't know the Lord, in which way we don't know, but Eli's being held responsible for it. We should take that to heart ourselves, because every person has free moral agency, and we'll get into that in a second, but we have a responsibility when we are the authority, whether it be in our house or in our positions in the local work. I think about elders. You know, just allow things to happen. If you're in that position, you're expected to do something, you're going to be held accountable for the tolerance or the indifference. You're going to be held accountable for that. Here Eli is. You did not rebuke, you did not restrain. It is them doing it. I completely agree. But it was his responsibility to handle the situation, and he did not. Look, yes?
You mentioned partly corrupt, I guess, depending on what you mean by corrupt. I'm persuaded that he was. He did not administer justice. And one thing, you mentioned that Eli was a priest. He was also a judge, chapter 4, verse 18. So if he'd take the possibility these sons were good and evil, lay with women, and so you don't administer justice and rebuke them, because of his position, two positions,
I'd
say that would be corrupt.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I kind of struggle, and this is where I'm trying to promote conversation amongst the brethren here. But you think about, depends on how you define corrupt, but I'd struggle with both of these, because not that Eli led the people himself down the wrong path, but he allowed this to fester. He allowed this to happen. He did not stamp it out. And so in doing so, is he corrupt? Is it corrupt in a different way than maybe we think? He didn't corrupt the nation, but he allowed it to be corrupted. And so it's just something that was, as I was studying, it came to mind. But we definitely see these other things, and we need to be mindful of it ourselves. Now look at, we'll keep going with Eli here. 1 Samuel 3:13. Now this is the Lord speaking to David in a vision. Says verse 13, for I have told him that I am about to judge his house. This is God telling David about Eli. I'm sorry. I've messed up Samuel, Saul, all this in my studies. Yes, thank you for correcting me. Okay. This is Samuel telling. No. This is God telling Samuel about Eli. I'll get this straight eventually. For I have told him that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves, and he did not rebuke them. There it is. So you've got over in verse 29 that you honor your sons above me, but it was your responsibility to rebuke them, and you did not. And so the question is, what was Eli's punishment for not controlling his children? We mentioned it already. They're going to die. He's going to put them to death. And what is said about the next priest? All right. In verse 35, but I will raise up for myself a faithful priest who will do according to what is in my heart and in my soul, and I will build him an enduring house, and he will walk before my anointed always. Not about what you want, not about what you do. He's going to be faithful to me. He's not going to let this lethargy creep in. He's not going to honor someone else before he honors me. You know, get to my notes for a second. You know, I think about this from the standpoint of Matthew 10. Look over at Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, verse 32. Now, we already know in Deuteronomy 5, 6 and 7, chapter 5, verses 6 and 7, and Exodus 20, I am the Lord your God, you will have no other gods before me. But if you look at Matthew 10, 32, this is, I think, kind of encapsulates what God's wanting. This is Christ speaking, but it says in verse 32, therefore, everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I will also deny him before my Father who is in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth and did not come to bring peace. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father and a daughter against her mother and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Now, I know this is Christ talking, but this completely embodies what Eli is being rebuked for. You honored your sons before me. What's the law? You'll have no other gods before me. When you start honoring other things before me, when you account for other things before me, then you're not of me. You don't love me. And so when it talks about here that I will set a man against his father or daughter, you're going to have to put them away. There may be a time where you're going to have issues with family, but God comes first. Eli didn't do that. And I felt like verse 37 really kind of encapsulated that of Matthew 10. Now, we talked about in our first and second class in Deuteronomy 4 and I think in chapter 7, this idea that they were to separate themselves from the other nations. Don't intermarry because the intermarrying will turn their hearts away. They were to drive the nations out because they would become a snare. And I made the point then that we need to be careful about who we spend our time with. We need to be careful, do what God would have us to do, surround ourselves with people of God. But in this instance, and this is the flip side of that, people are free moral agents. You look at Eli. Eli was a high priest. Hophni and Phinehas were supposed to be priests. It can happen within God's people that your hearts can be turned away. It can happen within God's people that you can be corrupted as well. People are free moral agents, and so it's about the choices you make. You can choose to let someone lead you astray. You can choose to love yourself and this world more than God. It's about the decisions you make. Some decisions will make it harder in your life. Doesn't mean they're wrong. I made the statement in the classes before that if you were to spend time with non-Christians or you were to marry a non-Christian, it doesn't mean you're sinning. But decisions may be harder in life because that's that much more that you don't agree on and you have to figure out in your life. And you're supposed to be of God, living a life of God and serving Him. It makes it that much more difficult if you don't have someone who's on the exact same page as you. Doesn't mean it's a sin. But that being said, we need to be careful of those within as well. And make sure that we're doing what we should and then encourage our spouse or our friends to do the same, because it's easy enough for people to turn away from God, even if they are of a family of God. And what I'm trying to express would be look over at First Samuel chapter 8. First Samuel 8:1, and it came about when Samuel was old, he was appointed that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and preferred justice. Then the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the other nations." And we'll get to the king part later, but Eli was rebuked in chapter 2 and 3 for not controlling his kids, not for rebuking or restraining them. But here's Samuel, And there is no indication that Samuel was to rebuke or restrain his kids. Why would that be? Maybe he did. That's kind of what I'm thinking. If he's not being judged here, if he's not being told or condemned here, then maybe he did while they were under his control. And it says here that they turned aside after dishonest gain. The idea is that Samuel was a godly man. He was a prophet. He was a judge. What's to say that Samuel didn't do those things, but that stuff still happens. People are free moral agents. And so, you know, we know so many different people who are into these different types of situations. We need to do what we can while we have those under our roof or in our lives to encourage and promote and to teach God's will. But ultimately, you may not have control over your kids or your family members or anything else. And you'll have to make peace with that and put God first. It's just interesting to me. I mean, it's a thought to think about that it can happen to those can be turned away from God. We can be turned away from God by those who are not of Christ. We can be turned away from those who are in the body of Christ and have chosen their own path, and they can draw us away as well. What do we do about it? And this is my question to you. What do you do about it then? If it can happen from both sides of the spectrum, what do you do? Give me one.
Reading, studying, following, knowing what you're supposed to
do. I agree. So, I'll put Rocky on the spot for a second. Can you like your favorite books are John and the first, second, and third John, correct? Okay. Do you have any scriptures from those? But I have a couple. I was curious to see if you'd be on the same wavelength as me. Is there maybe some things that were said in First John that might be applicable to this situation? I'm putting you on the spot, but I should have talked to you beforehand. Look over at First John for a second. We need to be reading and studying. We need to be careful of who we spend time with, but it's ultimately we need to put God first. So there's a couple passages I want to look at real quick. And 1 John 2:15 says, "Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away and also its lusts, but the one who does the will of God lives forever." I think of Paul in Galatians 2:20. "I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loves me and gave himself for me." I live for Christ. That's what we need to be doing. There are outside and inside influences that can be trying to turn our heart away. But we should be living for Christ. This is how we avoid those circumstances and situations. If you look over, just say in 2 John for a second, verse 3. By this, so 1 John 2, verse 3. "By this we know that we have come to know him, if we keep his commandments. The one who says, 'I have come to know him,' and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word, in him the love of God has truly been perfected. By this we know that we are in him." Keeping his commandments, that's how we safeguard ourselves. Outside influences can turn away, inside influences can turn us away. And then, for the sake of time, I won't mention it, but I had on here Ephesians 6, you know, the whole armor of God. Thinking about those things that you can use to protect yourself. All in all, this is an interesting study, and I wanted to present both sides of it from the standpoint of this nation is so very backwards that you would have a common woman who is going to be faithful to God, but you have this high priest who is, whether he be corrupt, he wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing, his heart was away from God. And then also the fact that from our application that outside influences and inside influences can have effect on us. We should be doing what they should be doing, which is to continue to read and study and safeguard our hearts. Now, moving into Samuel. So we read that Samuel came to Shiloh as a young boy. So once he was weaned, he came to Shiloh and he was ministering there. It says in verse 26 of 1 Samuel 2 that he had found favor with both the Lord and with men. And then we talked about that Samuel had a vision. So look at 1 Samuel 3, verse 1. It says, "Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli, and the word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent." And we talked about in verse 11, "The Lord said to Samuel, 'Behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I'm about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves and he did not rebuke them. Therefore I have sworn to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever.'" Think about the impact that had on Samuel. This person that he'd been ministering with, who had been taking care of him while he was in Shiloh. And the Lord judges Eli in this way. And the impact that it's going to make on Samuel as he becomes a judge. You see the judgment of the Lord. You know, we think about the love of God and of being obedient to Him because of the love He has for us. How about fearing the Lord and not wanting to walk down that path because of what happened to Eli? That I can't imagine how big of an impact that would have had. And then he had to go and recount those things to Eli. How much of an impact that had on a young man as Samuel was then. In 1 Samuel 3, 19 through 21, what does the scripture say about Samuel?
The Lord was with him. He heard him as a prophet.
The Lord was with him. He let none of his words fail. All Israel from Dan to even Beersheba knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Everyone knew that Samuel was a prophet. He moves into this leadership role eventually. And it's interesting to know, and as we move further, that everyone knew that he was a man of God. All right, so moving over to 1 Samuel 8. Now we have 4, 5, and 6. We won't spend a lot of time on that. That's where the Philistines come up against the Israelites. They come up against them. They're able to defeat them. The Israelites bring out the ark. The ark is taken. I did find it interesting. If you look, I'll mention it. Y'all don't need to turn there. But in chapter 4, verse 7, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, or you will become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight." That's what their response was when the ark was brought to... Where is that?
The camp, but
what was the location? Aphek? Anyway, when it was brought into the camp of the Hebrews, and they knew that. You think about the idea that the Israelites maybe have put away what God's all done, but these Philistines knew. Other nations knew of God. They've heard of His exploits. Here, you know, "Who shall deliver us from the hand of the mighty God? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness." They knew who God was. Yet, it seems like the Israelites had forgotten. Over in 6:6, it says... This is the Philistines. "When they do, why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaohs hardened their hearts when he had severely dealt with them? Did they not allow the people to go and they departed?" And this is when they're talking about returning the ark. The Philistines knew this story. It's interesting to me that these other nations know this story and reference back to it in these times of distress. And it appears that the Hebrew nation has turned its back on God. Now moving on to 1 Samuel 8. So we talked about how Samuel's sons turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. And so what happened because of that? They wanted a king. All right. So what was God's reply to Israel's demand? Listen to him. All right. What else was his response, though?
They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me.
They are rejecting me from being king over them. Now, we said that back in Judges 17 and Judges 21 that they said there was no king over Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. There was a king over Israel. It was God. They just didn't recognize him. They had turned away from him. And now, here you have them asking for a king, especially because they want to be like the other nations. What does God to explain to them about having a king?
He wanted Daniel to tell them everything that the king was going to do.
Okay.
Take,
yeah, just if you look at verses 10 through 18, verse 11, it says he will take, verse 13, he will also take, verse 14, he will take, verse 15, he will take, and verse 16, he will also take, and verse 17, he will take. And that's your sons, your daughters, the best of your fields and your vineyards, a tenth of your seed, your male servants, your female servants, your best young men, your donkeys, a tenth of your flocks, and then you will become his servants. That's what the king is going to do. He's just going to continue to take. And then when you cry out in that day because you're king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. You've chosen this path. But God allows it to happen. And the question, what's the point of the king? I agree. Completely agree. To guide them? Didn't they already have a guide? Well, and that's interesting to me. So if you look, I got to look in. All right, so let's say you've got God who rules over, and you've got his judges who come. What's the difference between these judges versus the king? I mean, God's the leader. These judges have been given the authority to lead the nation, to handle and bring them out when they need to be brought out. What's the difference between what this judge does and what this king does?
The king rules over. The judge doesn't rule over.
I mean, the judge passed judgment. He went out and the things. Well, let me go back. Let's look at 1 Samuel 8:20. We'll start at 1 Samuel 8:19. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, "No, but there shall be a king over us, and that we also may be like all the other nations, that our king may judge us, go out before us, and fight our battles." That's what they wanted the king for. What did the judge not do those things? That's what they wanted. The judges ruled over them through, they were God's instrument. They were God's agent to rule the nation. I mean, God ruled the nation. The judge was the one who imparted his words, the one who brought them out, who went out before them in battle. It's the one who judged the people. What's the difference between a king and a judge? Other than you need a not a symbolic figurehead, but you need an actual tangible representative that is supposedly over your nation. Which the judge was, but you need somebody, you need to be like all the other nations. That's what it boils down to. I got to looking at, you know, when he talks about these three things, that our king may judge us, go out before us, and then fight our battles. You look at Othniel in Judges 3. He judged and he warred. You look at Shamgar, who struck down 600 of the Philistines. You look at Deborah. Deborah was judged and she warred. You look at Gideon. He also warred and he judged. Samson warred and judged. They did all that. They did exactly what they're asking for. And then you think about the things that God did for that nation in those times. You think about God being their king. Who's more powerful than God? They went through the walls of Jericho just falling down. They went through the sun standing still at Gibeon. There was Gideon defeating the Midianites with just 300 men. That wasn't of Gideon, that was of God. Samson, when he died, he killed over 3,000 Philistines when he crashed the temple. And then you think of Samuel. And you think of what he did when they were warring against the Philistines. And the fact that when he was making that sacrifice, God sent the thunder and the Philistines were confused. King going to do all the same stuff? They already had a king, God, and his agent, the judge. The king does nothing else except for he is their representative. He's their figurehead. He's their idol, in a sense. They needed a representative here on earth to be the head of their nation as opposed to God in heaven. I mean, isn't that what an idol does? I mean, an idol, they put it in their home so they could worship it as opposed to worshiping God. Do you need something in your house that you can worship? Or can you not just pray to God, get down on your knees and thank him for what he's done for you? They needed a king to be able to see and lead the nation versus putting their faith in God. Yes, sir. Well,
he's tall and fast, but it could be they had no king, and then completely unconnected, they were doing what was right.
I take it as they didn't recognize any king. They had no king. They'd gotten so far away from God. In those last five chapters of Judges, it talks about all the wicked things that have been happening. Took a Levite and made him a priest in their home, and then they consecrated priests not of the tribe of Levi. Then they had the concubine who was cut up and sent to the nations. They basically did away with the tribe of Benjamin, stole wives to get the tribe of Benjamin back. There's just all this. They didn't recognize any king. They didn't recognize God as their king. They've rejected him is what, you know, first Samuel. And that's kind of the way I take it. There was no king. Because they didn't recognize him. You can choose to recognize the king over you or not. No, everybody did what was right in their own eyes. And that's how I take those phrases. There is no king if you don't recognize him. And they didn't recognize God as such. They wanted a figurehead to walk in front of them. And it's interesting enough, in all the miraculous things that God did for them, and then he had his instrument, his judges that would go and do these things. It's no different. They just wanted to be like all the other nations. Yes, sir?
Keith, I think there's a relevant important lesson for us here today about Eli and his sons and Samuel. And that, you know, it was God's plan that the judges would rule the nation. And the problem was that the sons of Eli and Samuel got corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
So they were following God's plan. And so they tried to do a substitute, which the substitute was the kings. And so God allowed that. But how did the kings turn out? Well, eventually it led to complete destruction of the northern kingdom. And after that, all the captivity, no more kings, and that plan failed. So, more or less for us today is take God's plan and follow it. And when it's not followed, go back and look to the original plan, and there's all things going awry you need to correct. Don't substitute a new plan.
It doesn't work, and in the end, God will always be glorified. Other nations knew of him when this stuff happened. When they were taken into captivity, God was glorified when they came back out. You can see, and everyone knew who God the Father was. The idea was is that these people would be his people. They would abide by his ordinances, and they would be seen as a great nation. And what a great nation it was that they keep these statutes and ordinances. What God would be with them that would allow them to this, such an understanding and wisdom. You know, that's God's plan will happen regardless. I mean, it's the idea that, you know, we worship him and we recognize him. Doing it his way is the only way we should do it. Otherwise, we will be judged. We will be punished. Any other questions or comments? Anything on what I presented this morning? All right. We'll move into chapter 4. That's when Saul becomes king. We'll move into that next Sunday, and hopefully I'll have some more material for you on Wednesday night. Thank you.